because it's really important. If I'm going to talk, it's just a matter of time. It's really to honour our team out in the kitchen that I don't go on and on and you miss your dinner or it gets cold or something like that. So this is the one talk, Mike and I, as we've dovetailed and partnered together on this conference, this is the one talk that's overlapping some of the things we've talked about. Yep, okay, so I've got 5 minutes to go, all right? It's all a matter of time. So I may, if you take your grace, I'll just actually may skip some slides as we go through. So when I see something we've covered, and Mike covered some great stuff in his flood talk, didn't he? And so one or two of my slides are around that area. So if I step ahead or skip over things, it's only because I feel we've already covered it, and I'd rather focus on the things I really need to do. But also, thank you, James, over the back there. He reminded me, again, Mike talked about rapid formation of landforms and things we observe all around the world. Just a reminder again, on the table out there, we have our free tracks, and one of them is entitled Surtsey Surprises. Has anyone ever heard of Surtsey? Well, somebody obviously has. Yeah, it's an island that came out of the sea, a volcanic eruption off Iceland back in 1960, and within just a very short amount of years, it had very ancient-looking landscapes. It had cliffs, it had rounded boulders, it had vegetation, it had animals, plants, all populating this new island. And people were astounded that they said if we hadn't known, hadn't actually seen it erupt, we would have thought it was a huge amount of years old. So that's a really good track where landforms can form quickly and also be populated very rapidly by all kinds of life forms. And we've also got Sikar Point, which my wife Desmond and I have visited. This is where James Hutton, that Mike talked about, got his first ideas of deep time, this philosophy he applied to the rock layers at Sikar Point. And that's where this whole idea of uniformitarianism was birthed, at Sikar Point. And geologists, they almost worship this place. They go there and it's the hallowed ground of, you know, uniformitarianism and long-age geology. And we've also got one here about the Three Sisters formation over in the Blue Mountains in Sydney. Some of you may have been to that. That's, again, great evidence for the flood, that landscape around the Hawkesbury area, Hawkesbury sandstone. And, of course, we've got how dating methods work. So this is how to get those romantic... Wrong track. Yeah. Okay, so I'm really talking about this. And we've also got another track called Biblical Creation, you know, Why Does It Matter? So make sure you get the tracks as well. All right, that's a hasty start. So just a matter of time, the age of the earth. Does the age of the earth really matter? Sometimes people say, you guys get so worked up about the age of the earth. You know, the young earth is just indefensible. Just don't worry about that. Just preach Jesus. And as we've hopefully covered over the talks we've had over the last couple of days, it's just really about the Bible is central, and the Bible is very clear about the chronologies, you know, the whole time frame from creation, the 6 days being very clear in the Hebrew use of the word day, through the chronologies. And so we're talking only in order of a few thousand years, not billions of years. And so time is really, really important. And I've got here is that time is actually the key. It's actually really the central core of the worldview issue. And we've talked about science, we've talked about operational science, we've talked about historical science. And one of the questions we've got tonight, and we're going to address this, the whole difference between the two types of science. But ultimately, between long ages and biblical creation, time is at the key of this whole worldview issue. First of all, evolution. We're talking about the big picture evolution, not just biological evolution, but evolution of stars, galaxies, the Earth, you know, chemical evolution, geological. All these things require deep time. They have to have millions and billions of years, otherwise evolution is completely dead in the water. So evolutionists must have deep time. That's why they'll never let go of it. Whenever there's evidence that comes up, like dinosaur soft tissues or these rock layers and all these sort of things, they will never deny the millions of years, because if you don't have millions of years, you don't have evolution. You don't have evolution, then you have... we can't go down the word of creation, because that's that religious stuff. There's a God there. I don't want to deal with a God. So I will hang on to my millions of years in my evolutionary story, because the spiritual consequences, I don't want to go there. So it's really our fallen nature. We don't want to let somebody else help us in our life, to take control of our life. We want to run the show myself. Thank you. I'm self-made. No God needed to run my life. So millions of years is really important to the evolutionary believer. But also, a young earth destroys naturalism. You know, the whole idea, again, that everything created itself, reinforcing again, you need to have millions of years. And so time really matters to these people. So this gentleman here, Sir William Thomson, he's also known as Lord Kelvin. So if you have a Kelvinator fridge, it was named after Lord Kelvin. And he was a very bright guy. He did a lot of thermodynamics, engineering, a lot of mathematics and so on around thermodynamics, coal and other things. And he actually did calculations based on the size of the Earth and all sorts of physical things he assumed. He came up with an age. He published an age of the Earth of being 20 to 400 million years. It's quite a long time, isn't it? You know, you're talking back in the 1800s, 1862, after Darwin has published his Origin of the Species in 1859. Lord Kelvin, an esteemed scientist, comes up, an engineer presents this, and Charles Darwin, he was seriously stressed about this. He actually said, he referred to Lord Kelvin, "He's my sorest trouble, an odious spectre. I'm greatly troubled at the short duration of the world, according to Sir William Thomson." So here's Darwin, he's seen this published thing, 20 to 400 million years, that's nowhere near enough time for my theories. I need more time, I've got to have time. And so he went on, I require for my theoretical views a very long period before the Cambrian formation. So Charles Darwin was starting to worry. I respect the scientist, my fellow scientist. He's saying the Earth's really young. It's only 20 to 400 million years old. Not enough time. I need more time. See, so time was important to Darwin. See again. So it actually goes through. But it also theologically to Christians. Deep time evolution, as we've talked about, millions of years, it actually destroys biblical Christianity. Number one, the credibility of the Bible. We've quoted the Bible a lot. It talks about, you know, an earth history of only a few thousand years ago. It talks about many of the scriptures. The New Testament refers to the Old Testament, again, taking it as real history. The whole credibility of the Bible falls apart if deep time is inserted in. The goodness of God, we've talked again about if God used evolution, bloodthirsty, wasteful, inefficient process over millions of years of suffering and bloodshed to create us, how good a God is he? He looked at all he had made and behold, it was very good, full of fossils and death and suffering, but it's still pretty good. So God's goodness is destroyed. The uniqueness of mankind, you know, are we created in God's image, special and precious to him and accountable to him? Or are we just, you know, the process of evolution by chance, no accountability, we're not unique, we're not special, we just think we are. So our uniqueness is also destroyed by evolution. I've talked about Jesus and his teachings. Jesus took Genesis' real history. He referred back to Genesis to from the beginning of creation. He created the male and female. So Jesus and all the New Testament writers believe that as real history. So they're not credible either. And of course, the whole basis of the gospel. Why did Jesus have to come and pay the price with a physical death? A physical death was not a price for sin and for separation from God. So the whole biblical narrative is destroyed by trying to insert millions of years and associated death and suffering into our history, into our worldview. Then we come people like Richard Dawkins. He's a well-known gentleman. I'm sure you've all heard of our friend Richard Dawkins. And he's talking about young Earth. Again, we talk about biblical creation rather than young Earth. I mean, because the Earth is, say the Earth's around the order of 6,000 or so years. That's 100 times older than I am. That's really ancient, isn't it? That's, you know, 6,000 years. That's a lot of time. But he says here, anyone who thinks the world is less than 10,000 years old, you've got to be staggeringly ignorant, which most of them are. Or if you're not ignorant, you've got to be insane. Well, as we know, Dr. Jonathan Safidi, yeah, he is not insane. He believes the Earth is young, PhD. You know, many, many scientists take the Bible as being believed. You know, and yet, here's Richard Dawkins saying, you've got to be insane or staggeringly ignorant. So, I talked, in one of my talks about it's impossible to actually measure age. There's no machine ever been invented. There's nothing existing now, and there never, ever will be any technology, any machine, any device where you can actually measure dates directly. You cannot measure age directly. So radioactive dates are based on assumptions. They're not scientific facts, right? I'm saying that blatantly. Radiometric dates, any dating method is not a scientific fact. It is based on assumptions. But I've got a little quick science lesson for you here. So here we have a measuring flask. You come into a lab and there's a measuring flask and it's got water in it. You can see there's 300 mils of water in the flask and you measure the drip rate of the tap coming in at the top. So there we have 50 mils an hour. So actually, how long has that experiment been running? So you measure your 300 mils nice and accurately. You measure your drip rate, 50 mils per hour. So how long has that been running for?
6 hours,
a good answer. Anyone else change that?
We don't know.
You don't know? Okay, well, you're obviously a bit ignorant there, Graham. Anyway, the young man, he gave a firm answer, and his maths is exactly right, but I'm sorry, you're wrong. Because I set this experiment up, and it's only been running for 1 hour. So why do you think he gave an answer, but I'm saying he's wrong? Because I know that it was only 1 hour. So what else could have happened? That's right. Was the flask empty when I started the experiment? That's a good point. We don't know, do we? That's right. Has the drip rate remained constant? No, we might have turned the tap on quickly and turned it off again. You see, again, so these are good assumptions. They may be true, but you weren't there. You don't know, do you? So all dating methods have to have some assumptions applied. So I've actually, and one of the things I'm going to, it's about an 8-minute video. I'm only going to play about a minute of it. It's an extract from our Evolution's Achilles Heel. So this is actually a very academic DVD. The DVDs are more, for mainstream, but the book is actually quite detailed. 9 PhD scientists. One of the sections there about radiometric dating. So this is a very short video clip, just to give you a feel of the thinking behind it. And then I'll quickly go through why assumptions are so important to dating and why they just cannot be proved and often don't stack up. So hopefully if the audio is plugged in. I'll cut it off when I think it's done a minute or so.
Many people are of the opinion that scientists can make direct measurements using this techniques of billions of years ages for rocks. And they use this then to discredit the history of the Bible. And this is really not the case. The physics behind radiometric dating is relatively straightforward. We have a radioactive element called a parent, which transforms over time into a non-radioactive element called the daughter. And this happens with a characteristic rate referred to as a half-life. That's the length of time that it takes half the parent element to transform into an equal amount of the daughter element. So over time, the amount of parent in the rock decreases and the amount of daughter in the rock increases. The scientists can use very powerful machines to measure either directly the amounts of these two elements or their ratio, and this ratio then can be used in a theoretical calculation along with the half-life to calculate an alleged age for the sample. Let me give you some examples. Radioactive carbon-14 decays to nitrogen-14. Uranium decays to lead. Potassium-40 decays to argon-40. And all of these are used in radiometric dating.
We don't actually measure the age with these methods. We actually are measuring the amounts of these isotopes in the rocks or fossils. And it's an interpretation using certain assumptions about these amounts that give us the age. But the age is actually not measured directly.
For many radiometric dating techniques, one of the assumptions is that there is no daughter element present in the rock when it is formed. Which, of course, we can't know unless we're actually there and can take a sample of the rock immediately after it was formed and do an analysis. Now, a small amount of daughter present at the time the rock is formed, if the rock is actually billions of years old, will not have a very significant impact on the calculated age. But if the rock is actually only a few thousand years old, even a very, very tiny amount of daughter present at the time the rock is formed will have a huge impact and give the rock appearances of being billions of years old. Another assumption in radiometric dating is that the rate at which the parent element transforms to the daughter element has been constant over time. Now, this has generally been borne out by experiments in the past, but recently some scientists in the US and Europe determined that the transformation rate of at least some elements, notably cobalt-60, cesium-137, silicon-32, and radium-226, do indeed vary with time. Now, they don't understand why this is, but they have noted that the rate varies with the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Now, the importance of this with respect to radiometric dating is that the assumption that the transformation rate is constant is clearly not true in the short term, and therefore may well be not true in the long term, which of course would invalidate the calculated ages.
Field, isn't it? It's a brilliant, brilliant DVD. It's really professionally presented. A lot of detail there. So, yeah, the assumptions are very much there, and we can't deny them. You know, do we know the initial amount? No, we don't. We don't know what the conditions were. Has anything also been added or taken away? Has there been water leaching through the sample over, you know, the alleged time since it was formed to take material away, or maybe to add isotopes in? You don't know. And again, has the rate changed? We don't know. And so these assumptions have to be brought to the sample. So the key thing is there, operational science gives us the very accurate measurement of the isotopes. You know, the number of parent atoms and the number of daughter atoms can be very accurately measured using brilliant technology. That is real science, okay? So you end up with a ratio of A and B, but the assumptions then are then applied to those that ratio to give you the date, and that's why it falls over. Okay, so we measure the rates now, but we can't assume it hasn't changed. And again, we don't know what the initial amounts were. So that's the key thing. So I'm going to just move on to about the assumptions themselves. There we've got it. So that's the first thing. Those are the four key assumptions of any dating method, especially radiometric dating. So I've got a personal example of how I found this in academia. So about 4 years ago, a friend and I, we decided to do a short paper with the Open University Remote Learning about the moons of the solar system. I'm a science nerd. I'm an electronics engineer. I'm involved in hardware and software development applied to environmental monitoring. And I really enjoy space travel, astronomy and all that. So I thought this would be great for my friend who is going through cancer treatment and myself to do as a peer buddy thing. So we went through the course. And part of this course of remote learning, we had a question about radiometric dating, you know, looking at moon rocks and the experiments they did to come up with the age of the moon based on these dating methods. So here we have this example here. Okay, there's your assessment. You have to come up with an answer. So, and I actually, you see, I got that right. I put down 3,750 million years ago based on that question. But if I zoom the question out, it's straightforward. It says you're asked to use radiometric decay to determine the age of a moon rock. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Let's do some real science. If you know there are originally 1,000 atoms of potassium-40 in a crystal and a mass spectrometer measures 125 atoms today, how old's the rock? Again, like our friend said there, we can do the maths. You know, we know this was at the start and we have this now. We measure it, do the rate, and we come up with the answer. Okay, so potassium-40 decays to argon-40 with a half-life of 125 million years. And I did the calculation, ticked the box, and got it right. But what was interesting was one of the other students said, oh, how do we know there was 1,000 atoms at the beginning? And the tutors came back and said, there are no assumptions radiometric dating. Don't try to bring creationism into this course. This is just somebody who asked the question saying, yeah, and, you know, so they were on the thing. There's no assumptions. Do not ask that question. And I didn't ask it, but she just, you know, said, well, how do we know that there was 1,000 atoms at the start? So you see again how you touch a sore spot when you try to say there are assumptions. So this for me was like, whoa, okay. So interesting, isn't it? If you know this, but we don't know that. How can you know what was at the start? You can't. So it's interesting seeing the worldview. So just one thing that really opened my eyes to what goes on in academia. Do not question the paradigm. Do not ask difficult questions. You will get a smacked hand. Anyway, so we talked again about these amazing technology, really, really cool instrumentation, mass spectrometers and so on, but they do not measure age, okay? You cannot measure age. They only measure isotope ratios in the present. So again, we're disagreeing about the history, not the measurements that are done in the present. Okay, so no scientific instrument can measure age. Every age calculation is based on assumptions, and scientists invent a story in an attempt to explain those measurements. Yeah, so we all do that. We have to bring our assumptions to the table. So, again, reinforcing this idea, in a respectful way that scientists, we come up with a story which may be credible to explain our measurements. That's how we have to progress if we're working with history. I want to give you a quick example of an age dating method that shows how fallible dating methods are. So back in the 1960s, we have Kay Berensmeyer, who's a very esteemed paleontologist. She worked in Africa. And they discovered this layer of volcanic ash called tuff, which is like a, you know, basically consolidated volcanic ash. And they called it the KBS tuff, standing for the K. Berensmeyer site tuff. So it was named after her. And they found all sorts of different fossils and so on in there. So, okay, so they dated it. They took some samples. They did radiometric dating on the ash, the volcanic ash, and they said it's 212 to 230 million years old. Okay, using scientific method, sounds good. It was published. We know this ash is that old. Oh, then they found some fossils underneath this ash layer, including elephant bones, pigs, apes, and even tools. Oh, okay. So we've got fossils underneath this 212 million year old ash layer, and yet they obviously, based on the evolutionary thing, can't be that old. Oh, okay, something's wrong here. There must be contamination. Something's gone wrong. So they chucked that date out. They took some more samples of the tuff and they did another measurement. And they did potassium argon sampling of feldspar and pumice, and they came up with a date of 2.61 million years this time. Yes, that sounds a lot better. It fits in with these fossils. That's good. We're very happy with that. So they published that date, and it was all good. Everyone was happy. And they confirmed that with three different independent types of dating: paleomagnetism, fission tracks, and so on, along with potassium argon dating. Everything seemed to agree. Date looks good, believable by the fossils. Let's publish that. Let's go with it. Trouble is, they even got the whole thing on the Time magazine. You become famous if you find fossils and so on. But then Richard Leakey found this fossil here, KNMR ER1470. They found that. And suddenly, but that fossil looks too modern to be that old. So they went back and they did more dating on it this time, because that fossil now, the date seemed to be wrong based on this new fossil we found. So they did more independent methods and they came up with 1.82 million years, more like it. That fits in nicely. So they then published that. See, again, the fossils actually override any radiometric dating. If you have your layers, but they have things called index fossils, if they don't agree with the radiometric dating, something's wrong with the dating. It's got argon contamination, measurements weren't done right, whatever. We throw that out and we come up until we find a result that confirms what we want to see. And the literature is replete with these examples. This is an amazing one, isn't it? Once upon a time, it's you come up with these stories, reject, until you get one that you want to stick with. And there's a whole range of other ones which I'll quickly go through. Again, the story keeps changing. On the border of the Democratic Republic of Congo, they found a relatively young volcanic layer that obviously was fairly recent. There was even some memories from local people there in their ancestry of this eruption happening. So we're talking hundreds or maximum 1,000 or so years, just right in that area of Africa. And so they took some samples from this, and they used what they call an isochron, which I haven't got time to go into. It's basically another method that supposedly takes the assumptions out of the measurements, and it provides an independent, verifiable age that's not affected by assumptions. And they came up with 773 million years on volcanic eruption that was obviously within historical memory through the ancestry and the legends and so on. Oh, okay, that seems a bit wrong. So they then interpreted that as a mixing line. Two areas of lava, one cooled down faster than the other, and you get a mixing line. So you've got to be careful where you sample, because it may be contamination from old rocks and newer rocks. So this was actually reinterpreted as a mixing line. So the date was wrong because of adjacent rock that mixed, contaminated the new rock once upon a time. So you can come up with a good story to explain the anomalies. And so, many times you end up with long ages. We look at things and we know that these are wrong. One of the things we have is interpretation panels. So if you go along to a dock site and you'll see this, here's a rock, and they say 13 million years ago this eroded and so on. So whenever you look at these interpretive signs around the place, there's always a date applied, isn't there? And yet often, I think somebody was saying, if you take away the dates, the rest of the story seems fine. Like Curio Bay, isn't it? You interpret it, there was volcanic eruption, there was flooding, and this forest got overwhelmed and became fossilized. Sounds good, we would agree with that. But it was X 50 million years ago or something. So we have to put on our glasses and look at these interpretive panels. What's the worldview behind those people who have interpreted that way? So we need to not take every date that's published as being scientific gospel, because it's not. One of the other areas they found out recently, Mike talked about uniformitarianism. Granites used to be held up as a perfect example of millions of years. Granite forms very, very slowly. Supposedly like a big balloon called a diapir of hot molten lava that came up through the crust over hundreds of thousands of years, very, very slowly moved its way up. And then it formed underneath the crust, cooled down slowly like a big pluton of granite. It took a huge amount of time to cool these massive amounts of granite down. Excellent evidence for deep time, millions of years. But these are huge. We're talking huge balloons of molten rock coming up very, very slowly. That was the standard interpretation for granite formation up until a few years ago. But now they're finding that things actually come out like pulses through cracks in the crust, up to only a few metres wide. It almost like injects these sheets up of granite which cool relatively quickly, and you get these layers forming. So if you've been to Dartmoor in England, you'll see a lot of these granite outcrops, and they almost have this layered effect. You know, they're eroded and like pancakes stacked on each other. That's the sort of the granite layering. So now the old idea of the slow diapirs has been thrown out, and they're now saying that granites are evidence of catastrophic formation. So see how it changes? Once upon a time. And again, I think the Evolution's Achilles Heels talks about that, this idea of rapid rocks. The DVD that comes with the 3-year sub talks about this. So we're talking a very different formation that new research has shown that the old way of thinking has been wrong. There's a reference there for it. So more and more we're finding that a lot of geological processes were actually catastrophic, not slow and gradual. And they look at things like crystals and so on. So again, lots of science there. I won't dwell on it too long, but it's just really important to understand again, the measurements we take in the present are great, but the interpretation is always fraught with danger. What about diamonds? Diamonds, we talk about, are a creationist best friend, not a girl's best friend, a creationist best friend, like carbon dating as well. So diamonds, we're told, take billions of years to form. You know, deep down in the earth, carbon is put under unbelievable pressure and heat, and eventually these diamonds formed, and then they're moved up through these kimberlite pipes to the surface, and then they can be mined in places like South Africa and so on. So diamonds take massive amounts of time to form. But there's actually a company in the States now that actually will take your loved one's remains, you create your, you know, loved family member, and they'll take the ashes and they'll form a diamond from that carbon remains in their special pressure vessel in only a few days and give you back your loved one as a diamond. It's called Gemesis. So that's obviously somebody's mum or dad, I guess. See, so diamonds, they don't take millions of years, you just take the right conditions, lots of pressure and lots of heat. So, see, again, these assumptions. So it's funny, but it's also a bit sad, isn't it? Yeah, so it's a perfect business opportunity for someone to set up one of these things. But if we look again, one of the things we have on our website is 101 evidences for a young Earth. And I think Mike referred to it as well, that the idea that the overwhelming number of methods we can look at to age the Earth, most of them give a young age for the Earth. Only a few appear to give it an old age. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. One of them is the amount of salt in the sea. And so we can actually measure the rate of salt, sodium going into the oceans at the moment from erosion and runoff and mineral decay and so on. We can also know that some of it's been subducted back into the continental margins, into the plates. So some goes in, some comes out, some comes out through sea spray and so on. So we're estimating about 450 million tonnes of salt, sodium goes into the oceans every year. 120 million tonnes are subducted or taken out. And so based on that measurement rate, assuming that this rate's always been constant, then the Earth, the oceans can't be any older than 62 million years. Now that's a cap of the age. Yet we're told the oceans are billions of years old. So even if you started with distilled water, you know, to get this way, the salt would be much, much more if the Earth was really ancient. But of course, we have the flood again, where you've got huge amounts of erosion and chemical deposition into the oceans, you'd imagine. And we don't know how much salt was in the ocean when God created it. I'm sure it wasn't distilled water, you know. So again, this is an upper level. This shows the millions, the huge, vast times don't stack up. And so we're looking at a maximum cap based on uniformitarian ideas. It does not add up. And so people start to interpret this differently. They come up with different things, you know. New discovery, maybe there's been recycled or accumulated differently. We haven't found the method yet, but there's maybe something we haven't yet found to how to explain this deficit in the salt in the oceans. Okay, and the creationists will say that age is too old. Again, the flood gives us a great account of how extra salt was added during the flood, and we don't know the amount at the start anyway. So again, age is just an interpretation for us both creationists and evolutionists. Also, the erosion of the continents. We can measure the erosion rates for mountain ranges and plains and so on. And even the Himalayas, Mike spoke about the Mount Everest has got the layers of sedimentary rock on the top with layers of fossils and so on in it. And the evolutionists also have a story about that too. Under the Ordovician Sea, layers and layers of sediment and fossils formed, and then it was all uplifted. And so our story matches, you know, both uniformitarian and Christian creationist views would agree that mountain ranges could have sedimentary layers on top. But the killer for the evolutionary idea is the rate of erosion, because there's about 200 metres, I believe, of sedimentary rock. And even at the measured rates of evolutionary erosion now, the top layers of the Himalayas would have been eroded away millions of years ago. No way those sedimentary caps could stay there for 50 million years. They would be long gone. So erosion destroys the millions of years, the measured erosion rates we have now. So the continents would actually be eroded away in only a few million years. Why is everything not down to sea level? Sure, there's uplift, but it does not match the rate of erosion. See, so we reckon that the continents will all be gone within about 14 million years based on the measurements we make today. Yet they're still here, so something's wrong with the rates. They interpret that differently. The evolutionists say that's too young. New discovery, maybe it was less in the past, or the mountains have been lifting up at the same rate to keep them going. So there's always a story to try to account for it. And again, we talk about the erosion during the flood making a big difference. See how we're both bringing assumptions to the evidence. We measure something, we make assumptions. We have to bring our worldview in to explain the story, which is more believable. And I'm going to skip this fairly quickly. Some of the evidences we see about rapid processes, and again, Mike's talked about some of these things. Mount St. Helens is a treasure trove of rapid geological formation that we've observed before our very eyes. These sedimentary layers, erosion, even coal formation in Spirit Lake, you know, logs sinking and forming, standing upright. Things like polystrate fossils, you know, tree trunks going right through multiple layers of sediment. Most trees, of course, rot away very quickly, don't they? A standing tree will start to rot, falls over. To actually bury a tree without it rotting over tens of metres of sediment, it had to be all buried together under one big intrusion of sediment. So this is another evidence for rapid formation of layers, polystrate fossils. Interesting reference that Mike made was to Derek Ager. He's an evolutionist. He believes in the millions of years, but he said we cannot escape the conclusion that sedimentation was at times very rapid in the past. I would say yes, it definitely was very rapid, particularly one point in the past, in the flood. Yeah, but the evidence around the world is now undeniable that most geological landforms have formed catastrophically at some point in the past. And again, we reference the geological column, which, by the way, a lot of people think the geological column is a nice fit that go all around the world. You can look and find this column of fossils getting from less complex to more complex. It's not. There's nowhere around the world is the column continuous. It's just different areas of outcrops, and they've synthesized it all together into a geological column. But the column does not exist right around the world. It's basically a combination of different areas that have been interpreted that way. And Mike covered the whole thing about the flood, giving a good explanation for the order in the fossils that we see. And 98%, I think, of the fossils are actually of marine origin. So you imagine the flood as it started to come, the breaking up of the Great Deep, the marine communities, coastlines would have been inundated first, covered with sediment and so on, as the water started to come up, and then more mobile creatures would have moved away. So you would have a very loose gradation from marine fossils upwards. And one of the questions we might have, what about all the human fossils? If humans and dinosaurs lived together, where are all the human fossils? Funny you should ask that. We've got it in our answers book, okay, dealing with that. We've got a good answers on why you don't, well, we haven't yet found clearly human fossils buried with dinosaur fossils. People say, well, why haven't we not found a Precambrian rabbit? If we found a mammal in the Precambrian rock, then it would destroy evolution. But they're finding out-of-place fossils all the time. But they're explained away about being reworked. The sediment's changed or reworked and it's in place, or it's been wrongly interpreted, or the radiometric dating of that layer was wrong. So there's always an explanation for out-of-sequence fossils. So again, Noah's flood washes away the millions of years, as Mike's done so well presenting today. So it's a fairly quick run-through dating using methods that we can't prove the past. So how do we actually know the age of something? There's actually only one real way that we can actually know for sure the age of anything. It's the only reliable way. So the Battle of Trafalgar on the 21st of October 1805. It's a historical fact. We know that for sure. It was written down. People saw it happen. They scribed it down in the annals of the day. So we know the Battle of Trafalgar happened on that date. The Battle of Hastings, about 9 a.m. in the morning, 14th of October 1066. You know, King Harold and all that. He got an arrow in his eye and so on. So again, a historic event that was recorded for our posterity. So we know that was accurate. So the only sure way of knowing anything is an eyewitness account. Now, I know there's actually quite a lot of evolutionary people say, well, the eyewitness account, eyewitness accounts are very fallible. There's lots of mistakes with people getting things wrong, and that's true. But the only way you can get an accurate thing is with an eyewitness. So, but there's also great correlation between eyewitnesses as well. There's a really interesting Christian writer called J. Warner Wallace. Has anyone heard of him? He cold case Christianity. He's actually a guy who used to be an FBI murder detective in the States, and he was a full-on atheist. But he actually went to the Gospels and looked at each of the different accounts from the different eyewitnesses, the different accounts, how the Gospels vary a bit in the accounts of different events. And he actually looked at this with a view of actually proving the Bible was wrong from a detective's point of view. So he looked at each of the accounts of different things that happened in the Gospels. You know, one person saw this, one person emphasized that, and actually brought him to faith. He said, as a detective, I looked at these eyewitness accounts and I was profoundly realized the whole account was true, because he knew from eyewitness accounts of an event, everyone has a slightly different viewpoint, a different interpretation, they see different things, they understand things differently. When you put them together, it makes a really, really credible account, and that brought him to faith. So eyewitnesses are powerful, but ultimately they're the only account we can have. The written record, eyewitnesses. We all have a birth certificate, so I guess your mum was at your birth. Mine certainly was at my birth. Other people, so people would have witnessed you being born and would have written down on the paper, signed, you know, so-and-so was born on this date at this place, and so your eyewitness gives you your age. Now, I'm not going to try it now, but some of you, one thing you could try is maybe how old do you think I am, and I say, well, 150, but now, often we look at people and think, oh, because they look like somebody you know, they're about that age, isn't it? But we don't know for sure. Some people are younger than they look, some people are older than they look. And so we look at something, we can only bring in a guesstimate of the age of things we actually know. And some people say, we look at the earth, how can you believe the earth is young? It looks old. Have you heard that? Actually, is anyone, why do you think the earth looks old? What features do we look around that makes the earth look old? Why would you say the earth looks old? In what way? Obviously, I look a bit older because of wrinkles and no hair and so on. But if you look at the earth itself, what are the things you would look at the landscapes and so on and say, that looks really old? Weathered rocks and so on, yeah. Erosion and so on, isn't it? Faded bright colours, yeah. So those sort of things. But again, that's right. So we look at certain things and we know that this particular thing ages, and so we put it on. But we don't know for sure, do we? Some things, like Surtsey, within a few years, we had an island that looked old, had rounded, eroded boulders, and yet we knew it was only a decade or two old. So yeah, we bring assumptions to our viewing of things, thinking how old they actually are. So our birth certificate gives us our age. And coming back to the Bible, how do we get the thousands of years from the Bible? Again, we took it, the Bible, if creation was real, at a fixed point in time and six ordinary earth rotation days. And then we have the geochronologies, you know, so-and-so begat so-and-so at the age and right through. And there are chronologies in Genesis and Chronicles, and of course in the New Testament as well. And so we have multiple paths of genealogies going through. And we don't believe there are any real gaps in there. And we've got some good articles on are there gaps in the chronologies. But even if there were some gaps, just assume there were, you're still talking in the order of only a few thousand years. And we've actually got a really good article in our Journal of Creation talking about the maximum age and the minimum age of the earth based on the biblical record. And I think it's about 3,900 BC to about 6,800. So it's about, you know, that sort of window based on assuming the maximum gaps, the maximum range of whatever. So we're still talking around the order of 6,000 or so years based on the biblical chronologies. That's where we get our dates from the Bible. So again, just recapping then, all radioactive dates are based on assumptions. And so are things like ice core layers and ice layers, and all these things are based on assumptions. How much was there at the beginning? What's the rate of formation? Has anything happened to them over the time? So they're not scientific facts. They are based on assumptions. Quality measurements in the present, but with assumptions applied. So the dates themselves are not facts. And actual evidence and plain logic support the biblical age of the earth. And we really hope that we've actually covered that in a convincing way, that you can believe the Bible, you can believe its timeline, and we believe it really stacks up. So the key thing is, you know, the earth is young. It's still ancient at thousands of years, but it's relatively young compared to those millions and millions of years. Because of that, naturalism is dead. Okay, so evolutionary naturalism, everything created itself, materialism is dead. Biblical history is confirmed. God is good. People are special. We are unique. We are loved by God. We are accountable to God. Sin is serious. You know, we have a holy, loving God, and our sin is serious to him. Jesus Christ can be trusted because he believes the Bible. He is the creator. He is the savior. And we have been created for a purpose. So each one of us can realize that we are on this planet today in this age to do something, to live for him. We have a hope and a future. We're not living in a mush of hopelessness and bleakness with nothing to live for. You know, the gospel is fantastic, isn't it? So we can trust the Bible. We can trust the history contained within the Bible. And we have to call into skepticism things that are against the Bible. And what's the reason people don't want to accept the evidence that's there? So again, a very speedy run through. I just want to finish by just pointing out some, you know, resources we have on the tables there. One of them is The Deep Time. This is a really, really easy to read, excellent book talking about where the idea of deep time came from, the philosophy of deep time. It's not a scientific fact. It's an assumption or philosophy, a framework of interpretation that James Hutton started in 1797. And it goes through again in more detail of what I've talked about why the evidence supports the young earth. Of course, the Creation Answers book, 60 Most Asked Questions. Stones and Bones, this is one of our old classics, talking again about fossils and about formation of things, radiometric dating, and the age of the earth. It's a really good little booklet, a classic. And of course our intro pack with our answers book and DVDs. We have a more detailed DVD pack of DVDs. Now actually talking about DVDs, we were asked today about the Genesis Academy. Is it available on the streaming service? Yes, it is. Mike's looked it up. So who's asking about the... Oh, yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah, so yes, it is. All episodes are available for download. All our DVDs are now available on our streaming service. So if you haven't got a DVD player, you can get them as a streamed service. Exploring Geology by our famous Mr. Hibb, the little grasshopper guy. Youth Magazine, 6 days, we've talked about that. Really good book for young people. And we'll leave it with that. But just a reminder again, we've got Q&A last session. So over dinner, if you've got any other questions, we've got a number, thank you, already. Mike and I have talked about it. But there's a box on the table. We can still take late-breaking questions if you would like. So we'd love to try to address your questions. There's been a lot thrown at you over the 2 days. But hopefully we can just wrap up after Mike's climate session. The last one will be Q&A, open-ended. We won't keep you. We won't go on forever. But if there's anything you want to ask us, please do write it down, pop it in the box, and we'll do our best to respond graciously, biblically, and honestly. And if we don't know, we'll tell you, okay? So, all right, so thank you for that, and thank you for listening, and look forward to a nice meal. I think we're bang on 5 o'clock, 10 seconds. Okay.